You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I have the enormous pleasure of speaking with Truth in Advertising, someone I know from a different context. We're on a board together, Shepard Fairey. Shepard Fairey, I'm saying it right? It sounds like the boat that goes across the, yeah.
Yeah. People always want to say Farley, Fairey, like, No, it's just like Tooth.
Just that.
Yeah. Tooth Fairey, Shepard Fairey.
Shepard Fairey. So, if you've been living under a rock, you don't know that name. But otherwise, you know him as an artist. Well, how do you describe yourself? You're an artist, you're a street artist, you're an activist, you're a founder of both a brand and a clothing company. I think you're the founder of the clothing company. Yeah. And
yeah, I am.
Are you the head honcho there at the clothing company, the CEO?
I'm the creative director. I'm not a CEO of anything.
That's good. Wise. Good move.
I let other people handle that. I do a lot of different creative things. I would call myself a graphic designer as well.
Graphic designer, yeah.
But it's all just a path to me using art and visuals as my way of communicating with the world, of putting my ideas across. And I really believe in that being democratic. I believe that art should be accessible. I think that visual art has this issue of being perceived as a bit upper crust, elitist, and intimidating. And I want visual art, because it is such a valuable thing within culture, to be as inviting as music is, as film is, as television is.
Well, yes. I think that's one of the things that, you know, before I knew you, I was so attracted to your art because of that. But just like music, and I mean, you know, there are places you can go to hear music. Well, you can hear it walking down the street, and that's wonderful. And you can hear it in your car, and you can hear it. And then there are places you can go to hear music, and they feel like clubs or concerts or whatever. And then there are places that you can go to hear music and art, and the music is no less extraordinary, but the setting is, it's so set apart, right? I mean, it's so there's so many protocols that are not spoken that you discover when you step outside of them, right? I mean, you know, I remember going to a relatively small venue to hear a quartet or a chamber group do like Shostakovich, and I'm not a classical music guy, so I don't know Shostakovich from Beethoven from whatever, and it was so exciting. The music was so exciting. I mean, I could barely stay in my seat, and I looked around. In fact, the conductor, the fellow who's conducting this little court or group, was up on one leg. It was like the old Ian Anderson from Aqualung. Literally up on one foot, just raging. And I looked around the room because it was so, I was like jumping out of my skin, and everybody was sitting there completely still. And it was the opposite of democratic and accessible. It was like, oh, I'm not supposed to do that. He can do that, right? The conductor can do that, but clearly we're not supposed to do that. And so it is so off-putting. So, and I think that's probably one of the things that I've always been drawn to about the stuff you do. But I want to back up in just a little bit. You know the story, so you're bored with it. But you started as a skater. I mean, you're a skater and grew up in, I think, South Carolina.
Yeah.
Ended up at art school. But how did you go from, well, first of all, when was the last time you were on a skateboard?
It's been probably about 5 months since I was on a skateboard. But
well, that's a short. I thought it was going to be like 5 years or maybe more.
No, I used to skate a lot, and I just have slowed down gradually. And unfortunately, I just don't have a lot of time. And skateboarding used to be the visceral thing that gave me that powerful feeling of progression and accomplishment and thrill and escape. And believe it or not, I get that from making art.
Oh, I totally get it.
And so it's not that skateboarding isn't fun anymore. It's that it was essential. It was a survival tool for me. And now my art is more my survival tool, but I am who I am because of skateboarding, which I've been thinking about this because February 15th in just a week will be the 40th anniversary of when I got my first real skateboard. I got my 14th birthday. I got my first real skateboard, and it was a life-changing day because I'd been going to a conservative private school and everyone was preppy. I felt like I had to conform to other people's ideas of, you know, what was cool in order to have any social standing. And I was unhappy with that, but didn't know how to find an alternative. Skateboarding and punk rock gave me an alternative.
Oh,
it's such a cliche, but it's absolutely true. And also, I'd like to draw from the time I was a little kid, but drawing was not cool. Being good at soccer and football was cool, and drawing was kind of something I did almost embarrassingly in the shadows because it was so not cool. It was nerdy. But within skateboarding and punk rock, making your own homemade t-shirts, stickers, stencils for your skateboard, building ramps, all these creative things, building your own scene and having creativity and a sort of irreverent aesthetic to go with that. That was part of the social currency within that. So I could thrive with my art within that realm.
Well, and then you transferred to, did you end up graduating from Idlewild?
Yeah. I was,
which is what, not, it's definitely not preppy. It's definitely not.
No. My parents more or less insisted that I go away to art school because they didn't like the crowd I was running with in Charleston. A lot of people that cut school and smoked weed and things like that. I was not a bad kid. I was rebellious, but I wasn't. Yeah, I didn't do any drugs in high school. I barely drank. But my parents were very worried, so they said you need to go to art school. And I was sort of resistant, but at the same time, was like, could be worse. I love making art, so if I get to focus on that, that won't be so bad. And I got kicked out of the North Carolina School of the Arts summer program the summer after my junior year. I was supposed to go there my senior year, and I spent the night out without permission. I thought I was more slick than I was, and I got caught. And so my parents, between late July and September, had to find a new school, and this school had was only a year old in Idlewild, and they accepted my portfolio. So I went there, and it was a very, very lucky thing that happened, because California had a great culture. It was the first time my teachers were not condescending and more like drill sergeants. I had a really, really excellent special experience in Idlewild. I was around kids from LA and San Francisco, but also Korea and all over the country in the world. It was in a small group of people, but really cool people with a lot of different tastes. So it was good training wheels for me going off to art college. And I put together a good portfolio when I got into the Rhode Island School of Design. And that's a difficult school to get into. So
Yeah, indeed.
I was lucky, lucky that I went to Idlewild because I was able to focus. And it also shifted my work ethic. I had been thinking that I'd somehow pull off becoming a professional skateboarder and would never have to worry about doing that well academically. And I knew that I was intelligent enough, but I just didn't consider it that important to do well in chemistry. And so which was just horrifying to my parents, because they were always like, if someone gives you something to do and you don't excel at it, then you're closing doors, you're embarrassing yourself. And I was just like, eh, whatever. And but then art gave me such a sense of accomplishment and purpose that my work ethic just, you know, fell into place. And now, you know, I've been a workaholic basically since college, because it's not, when you enjoy what you're doing and you get therapy from it and you're able to create something that you're proud of that you share with people, and it's a social tool as well. What's not to enjoy about putting a ton of time into that?
Yeah. It's what do they say that if your job is what you love, you'll never work a day in your life.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, and, but okay. So did the, maybe I, you know, I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but when did you start to think of yourself, or do you, as an activist? I know you do, right? Was it there from an early age? And because it seems like, from, you know, it seems like your art sort of transitioned, I'm not sure if that's true, but transitioned from exploring how, making stuff you wanted, but also exploring how art moves people, how art is perceived by people, is used by people. And then, you know, over the years, there's been a, seems like there's been a shift in the direction of pointing in a direction, of pointing in a certain direction that is related to issues. Well, we, you know, social issues, issues that, well, between you and I, issues that people should be paying attention to. But you know, things about which there are activists. And that, it, I mean, I may have that wrong. That may not be, I mean, because art is always in some ways getting people to take a look at how they're seeing the world. You know, that's certainly activist, right? But it's a different, it's a pointing outward that seems to have changed.
Yeah, I've evolved, but the seeds were planted by punk rock and also by some of the people I was around who were, I had a couple of art teachers in high school that they were very supportive, and they opened my eyes about the responsibility of artists, that it's not just about escapism. It's also about how you carry forward the mantle of civilization in a way. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, that could sound maybe a little pretentious, but I think that it took me a little while to feel confident in addressing issues, because a lot of, you know, a lot of times the issues are complex, and I thought, well, there are people who do this professionally. They're involved in policy and politics. They're academics. Maybe they should be the ones talking about this. And then I realized that a lot of the people in politics especially are intentionally obfuscating what's truly going on, and that sometimes art can cut through what is simple but has been made complicated to cloud things for someone else's agenda, and everyone is perceiving it that way when you could articulate it in a more simple way that deconstructs that and has a different point of view. So it took me a while to feel comfortable doing that. And initially,
you mean like that you could have that what you had to say or think about those things? Well, you're quote, just an artist.
Right.
Is that what you mean by that? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, earlier I felt more comfortable addressing big concepts like police brutality or surveillance or racism more than things like universal health care or the war in Iraq. It took me a while to become more confident dealing with the news issues in the news cycle and feeling like I was educated enough. But punk rock, The Clash, The Dead Kennedys, and then reggae like Bob Marley, and then later hip hop like Public Enemy, all those things were making me think that when there's a status quo that's unhealthy, somebody has to have the courage to speak out about the problems. And if they feel they can point towards solutions, also point towards solutions.
Yeah.
So this is a gradual process for me, but it's been very intentional, and I spend a lot of time educating myself about the issues, so I do feel qualified to talk about them in a way that I can stand behind. And that's a layer of the problem solving. Art is about, for me, it's about, all creativity is about problem solving. And there's the, if you're a musician, how do I make an enjoyable piece of music? Oh, now how do I add in lyrics that say what I want to say? And the intensity of the lyrics might actually be very different feeling-wise than the appeal of that melody. But the bundle is maybe more powerful because they have this dichotomy. And I look at the same thing with some of the visual art I make. I make things that are, you could call them propaganda style, clearly provocative, but I also make things that are very, very pretty and seductive and inviting. Sometimes it's a combination of the two in one piece, but it's all about getting people to engage with an idea that they might dismiss based on a pre-existing prejudice otherwise.
Art has been, when you look back historically, I mean, art is free art, and the work of works of artists of all sorts have throughout history been pointing at inequity, pointing at injustice, pointing at a future that, you know, people are dismissing. And I think you're right. I think there is that notion, which I think is cultivated by those that want to control, to be in charge of that process. There is that notion that, you know, unless you can articulate clearly all the ins and outs of something, then your intuition, everybody's intuition that, hey, there's something really wrong here. And I can't tell you what it is, but I know there's something about this. And we're supposed to dismiss that because, well, you know, unless you can address it in great detail in a particular sort of way, then you really have nothing to say about it. And that's been bullshit for years. Yeah. And it's also contradicted by the actions of, I mean, look at all the rallies that are going. Like, everybody picks music that they think is going to inspire, and they're frequently right. They're going to inspire that group of people that's going to come to that rally. And, you know, they're not just doing that because, oh, they just, you know, when you're at a rally, you put on music, whatever. It's like quite, you know, there's that art and the direction for the future have been not all art and not always, but have been, you know, linked together for so long. And so kudos and bravo and it's you know, it's great that you get to do that and still get to play at this thing that you're play in the big sense of the word, right? That wrestle with, how do I do this to do that thing that I really want to do? And fabulous, really.
Well, it's extremely fortunate that I have art which allows me to escape while I'm creating. I'm dealing with all the heaviness in the world. I'm very sensitive to all the injustice in the world. And so it can feel heavy just to get up in the morning, but art is a very therapeutic escape. But then as I'm escaping, creating, I'm also addressing the very things that upset me in the art that I can put back out there and not feel like I'm just a complicit spectator. I can push back and I can share that with people, find allies, find some solidarity. And that escapism and engagement packaged in one thing at different stages of the process is such a beautiful thing that I can't really, you know, imagine what my life would be like without it. And I don't take it for granted at all.
Can I ask you a few questions just about the art itself?
Sure, of course.
First, early on, right, you were making, I don't know what you were doing in the studio at, you know, at art school at Idlewild and whatever, but certainly the stickers, the, you know, Andre the Giant has a posse stickers, those that sort of started to appear, what's that? And then it was started to appear everywhere, right? Was really small scale. And then the world, it just got ramped up, both in terms of the number of places the stuff you were doing got seen, right? Because it wasn't just, oh, a sticker here and a sticker there. It was like, holy shit, everywhere I look, there's one of those. And then it went from that to, like, you know, enormous size that is out there, right? It's like stories tall, building stories tall. And just, I mean, for one thing, how the hell does that get done? Not to go from small to big, but like, you know, the one that's just so amazing, you know, when it's first seen, and I haven't seen it in person, but like, what is it, Nelson Mandela, you know, what is it, 10 stories high on a building? Yeah. Like, how does that, like, is there some sort of cheating that, like, how does that get done?
Well, anything in art, someone will say is cheating. Using a paintbrush was cheating when everyone else had just been using like bloody elbows prior to that. So, you're like, nope, that's cheating.
You're not allowed to do that.
The camera obscura to get the proportions right that Da Vinci used, that must have been cheating, right? But
that's not real art.
Yeah, that's not real art. To address the evolution and then also how I do things at scale, I'll try to make it quick, but I started with a $4.25 an hour skate shop job making stickers, but I'm pretty resourceful and crafty, and I became friends with the employees at the copy shop, and I would print a t-shirt of a band that they liked and give it to them. And I knew that that would yield hookups on stickers for the duration of their employment there. And I, I found a lot of,
don't try this at home, kids. Actually, yeah. Do try this at home.
Yeah. I found a lot of ways to make things in volume economically because I had to. I was broke, but I had a lot of hustles. I started my own screen printing business. I would print my own stickers, print my own t-shirts, print my own posters. One of the reasons that my early work was black and white or black, red and white was because it was efficient to make it and it's bold.
Yeah.
The people mistakenly think that I developed a very successful street art identity and then sold out forming a clothing line. I actually was making t-shirts from the very beginning of doing my street art because t-shirts were the utilitarian currency of the cultures I was involved in: skateboarding, punk rock, hip hop, graffiti, street art. That everybody wore t-shirts. Streetwear wasn't even really a term yet, but I made and sold my own t-shirts. And it took a long time for that to become successful, but I was doing that to finance the things that I was doing on the street that had to be paid for somehow. And so they were, you know, the as the street art was growing, I was trying to be better at getting my t-shirts in stores and things like that. And I would use the money from that. I would use the money from contract printing jobs to invest into better printing equipment so I could print bigger. But really, believe it or not, a lot of those huge paste-ups that were taking over billboards and, you know, sitting on the sides of abandoned buildings, those were just tiled up blueprint copies from Kinko's that were black and white. And I, once again, I would find the late night employee who I could give them $75 and they would let me use the oversized copier all night long. And they would hit me up like, "Hey, we just got 20 new rolls of oversized paper. So my boss isn't going to notice that a couple of rolls have been depleted." Now that I can afford to, I make sure that everybody gets paid properly. But, you know, this was I hustling on the, you know, the corporate dime, hoping that they wouldn't notice was part of what I had to do originally. And I've just built gradually. My success as an artist doing art shows was very minimal at first. But as I started to get shows in some alternative spaces and cafes and things like that, I always just reinvested the money. When I built out a website and I was able to get e-commerce, and then my selling my limited edition prints online started to happen, I always reinvested the money. So the scale has been a very, very gradual process over 30 years. But the huge murals, they're basically one-use stencils. I design the image based on the measurements of the wall. I print out the entire image in 3x4 foot sheets on the same kind of oversized copier that I used from the beginning. In grayscale, I have my color proof, knowing where all the colors are going to fall. And then my assistants and I cut the stencils right on the wall after we lightly spray mount the sheets a few at a time up. And we work like a grid across the building. And we work very quickly. It's a lot of elbow grease. It's really hard blue collar work, but it will translate to a very effective mural in the end. And there's something really satisfying about working for half a day, going to lunch, getting down off the wall, stepping back and seeing how it's evolving, because you're right in front of your eyes, you're seeing the cityscape transform. It's at such a scale that it's not just something that people have to be paying close attention to see or have to seek out, it is going to confront right. them from a car, from the sidewalk. And this is profound, because what I decided at the beginning of my career was that so many people felt like there was no meaningful way for them to participate in the social, political, cultural conversation, that they became apathetic. They didn't see a path to having a voice. And something as simple as putting some stickers up, disrupting the control of public space, which is totally dominated by government signage, commercial signage, and advertising, giving the individual some little disruptive form of expression, that could unleash a chain reaction. Now, when a mural is taking up the entire side of a building and it's talking about something other than you need to buy these clothes or this car or right. whatever, I think that this is a valuable thing for people to have in their lives.
Totally. I love that. I just, when you said it that way, like, you don't have to walk into a room, even a room that's dedicated just to that piece, right? You know, yeah. in a museum, you don't have to walk down the hall and come to that piece. It's there, and it's there, and it's there when you drive in that direction, and there when you drive in that direction, and there when you turn the corner, and it's fabulous. So, yeah. The other thing that as I was thinking about this conversation we're going to have, and it's, I think, and this may not make any sense, I'm not sure I'll be able to articulate it the way it makes sense in my head. this may be me importing this to you, so tell me I'm full of it, but you seem to have an ability to see the universal in the particular, the instance of, you know, this person doing that person suffering, and yet it is, you see it bigger than that, and the particular in the universal, like, you know, there's a social movement, there's a war, and you are able to convey, it's not just a war, whatever that means, right? Whatever images people conjure up when the word war happens, there's the individual, the effect on all of these individuals in their very personal lives. They're very private, very, very powerful, very huge in a certain way and small in another way, suffering. And that is a feature of your stuff that, at least in my eyes, that that's, I don't know if it's always there, but it's been there for a very long time. And I wonder if you ever think about that, or if I'm just making this all up, which is fine. That's what editing is for.
No, you're not making that up. What you're talking about is something that I've tried to articulate also. I think people understand it intuitively when they see it. And the way I would describe it is, I'm looking for things that function well as archetypes and as symbols, but without taking on that generic quality that a lot of archetypes and symbols do. The, you know, finding an imagery vocabulary range that is relatable, but is illustrated, and, you know, even the references that I work from are selected in a way that I think is special and universal. And that's not always easy, and some pieces achieve that better than others. But the challenge of making people understand what something's about, but it also doesn't feel generic. It touches them because it stimulates some empathy. They can relate to it. They can see themselves in the person or the situation I'm illustrating. That's really crucial because people don't really shift their opinions unless they're moved emotionally. And then they want to justify that emotional response intellectually. So the intellectual evolution is usually based on an emotional response. And that's why propaganda can get people to do really bad things, because it can go the wrong direction.
Sure.
But I think you can see in my work that I'm trying to find the humanity in both the subjects and cultivate that in the viewer. And I avoided cliche imagery when I was younger because I really hated things that were sappy. Like when I saw the movie Forrest Gump, I got angry. Happy endings I thought were fake and bothered me. But now I love to illustrate a flower, a sunset, clouds, the ocean, people, their beautiful faces, their eyes, but do it in a way that doesn't feel like a Hallmark card, but still connects with why people are so drawn to those kinds of images in the first place. They're all things that we have an emotional response to because, the healthy water, healthy, sky, beautiful sky, a good sunset, all those things make us feel like things are right in the world. And when those things are threatened, a lot of times we're not really thinking about that side of it, but I can sometimes bundle the celebration with the warning. And whether that's, things happening to humans or things happening to the planet, this is really important to me to try to achieve with my images.
I love the way that you put that together, the celebration and the warning. We have an example of one of those that there's two questions here. Let me ask that one first. But the other is, sometimes we hear movie directors, musicians, composers, they have a certain feeling about a certain piece. I mean, they're obviously, they want everything on the album to be great, but then when they land on one of them, they're like, I knew this was it. And I knew this was, do you get that feeling with some of the work that you produce? Obviously you're always looking for that, right? You always want that to be every piece to be the best.
Yeah.
It's always the best. But yeah. But then sometimes it's like, you're moved. You're producing it and you're moved. And
yeah. Well, when I work on anything, I'm trying to achieve that, like you said.
Sure.
And I feel like I have enough practice to make something solid every time out, but they're not always the ones that sort of capture lightning in a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I'm not the one that's wholly responsible for that. When things become a reference point and a viral phenomenon, sometimes it's just creating imagery that is needed in that moment for what's going on in the world. And the example I would give that's relatively recent, not even that recent now, but people I think remember it. When I did the We the People series for the Trump inauguration / the first women's march, and they were kind of the anti-Trump inauguration posters, but that series of two women and a boy that were a Latina, a young black boy with dreadlocks, and then a Muslim American woman with American flag, hijab.
Oh, there it is. Lightning in a bottle. That is the one that sprung to my mind as soon as that's just unbelievable. Yeah.
Well, those three images were made to be symbols of how these groups that Trump's had been disparaging were equally American, deserved to be treated with equal dignity, and could be portrayed as equally patriotic. And the doing them, I felt like it was an important mission because I worked with an organization called Amplifier and my friend Aaron Huey on conceiving the project. And we both felt that with all the anger and division that had been stoked by Trump, that something that was unifying was that was where the vacuum was. That was the space that needed to be filled. That was the thing that the alternative that wasn't being provided. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. almost everyone I talked to said, that's not the way things are going. No one's going to care about that. That's going to seem unrealistic and sentimental. And yet when I completed the images and Aaron and I started to promote them as part of a Kickstarter for the Women's March to distribute images and messages, it ended up being the most successful art Kickstarter that's ever happened because people responded to the images. They felt, a lot of people felt shocked and unsure of what to do in the wake of Trump being elected. It was, I think that these prints were a nice thing for people to use as symbols of their opposition. And they were seen at women's marches across the globe. I think we eventually documented 60 different women's marches that included those prints as a pervasive element. Mm.
Well, yes. Wow. That is the thing. As soon as I asked the question and you started to answer it, I saw, I don't know two of them. But I know the woman. Is it the woman, a very beautiful face with a flag, a U.S. flag like hijab?
Yeah, exactly.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, that's a woman named Manira who is a friend now, but she's great. She lives in New York, but she's from Queens originally. But she's a Bangladeshi Muslim, and they're all real people who also served as symbols. And I like that they weren't famous people, that they could, you know, stand on their own without being famous. And you know, when I think about the Obama poster, of course, was a successful poster for me, and I'm really grateful for the attention it got and maybe the benefit to his campaign, of course, because I believed in him as a candidate. But it also was that image was riding along with the charisma, the oratory skills, the everything that was captivating about Obama himself. And so, you know, in some ways, I feel like the We the People prints didn't have that advantage, and therefore are more of an achievement, and maybe more likely to make people think about the importance of every citizen rather than just people who have already achieved noteworthy things.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's a perfect example of that universal in particular, wrapped in a bundle and lightning in a bottle. Indeed. Indeed. Well, I'm trying to be conscious of your time, and but I do have one question which I sometimes ask. So I may have asked you, but If I knew what I was talking about, what would I have asked that that I haven't, and that is, you know, it feels like it's worthwhile saying. There doesn't have to be an answer, but there can be.
All right. Here's this probably isn't that helpful, but I'll ask you what is driving you to do this podcast?
Well, there's a multi-tiered answer to that. And so one is, thanks for asking that, by the way. It gives me an opportunity every time I ask myself that. So at the most sort of banal level, I've been a teacher for most of my professional, I don't even know if I was a professional when I started, career, whatever that is. And I love it. Like, you know, you were talking about how some of the most, like the thrill that used to be skateboarding, not that it's terrible, but is now art, making art. For me, that thrill, I mean, I'd say sometimes to friends, you know, who are not teachers, that some of the most exciting times I've ever had in my life have been in classrooms, both as a student and as somebody who's sort of, you know, in this role of guiding this thing, whatever guiding means, working with the forces that create what happens in a room. And so when I moved from California, the last thing I was doing in my teaching career, I was teaching at UC Santa Cruz. This was after I left the school I started. I was teaching UC Santa Cruz and I was loving it. You know, it was fun and absolutely juicy and always is. And it turns out that you can't be out of state and still teaching. And it was suddenly, and the environment here, there weren't those opportunities. And so it's like, well, you know, there is this technology out there. I wonder what that would be like to that, that, that. So some of it was an experiment. And the thing that guides it, really, curiosity invited, is really the things, what am I curious about? What are people doing that seem to me to be really interesting or really important? And every once in a while, you know, the version of lightning in the bottle is the combination of both important and interesting. And so it's that. It's like, you know, that I suspect I'll do that until, in one form or another, and until I can't, until they just wheel me out, right? You know, because when a conversation, right, like, so, you know, this could be an interview, and I guess there's an element of that, but when a conversation emerges from and takes on a life that I didn't expect, you may have expected it, but I didn't expect, it's one of the most gratifying and exciting things that I know of. So how's that?
Yeah, that's great. I mean, part of what I think you're saying is that having people share ideas with each other has a benefit in many, many ways, and it's almost unquantifiable. I know I feel that way. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, your effort to reach out to anybody that you're interviewing is to give voice to what they're doing, but also you're going to be asking questions you want to have answered. And there's a, you know, there's molecules colliding, there's things happening, and there's even maybe a small element of risk of it going in a direction you didn't want it to go, or somebody responding in a way that you're not expecting. But that's part of the what makes it exhilarating. If I could say, what question would I want you to ask me? Maybe that would be, what would I want to say to the audience? And what I'd say to the audience is that I do what I do because I really, really care. And it has a therapeutic component for me, but I care about people. I care about the world. And the, you know, the irony of caring is that it takes sensitivity to feel the things that make you want to creatively respond. But then a lot of times how people respond is really brutal. And when you're sensitive, that can be painful. So
indeed,
the question I would ask everyone out there is, don't worry about, I will survive through my pain, but do you want to see a world that's more painful or less painful? And do you want to be somebody that's making things more painful or making things less painful? And this is about everything from big issues, like do people from other countries, other religions, other cultures, other races matter less? Are their lives less valuable? To, you know, big things like that, to small things like, is anonymously ridiculing people what you would want them to do to you? You know, little things like that. So, you know, this is sort of when people go, well, you know, what's driving you? I've explained what's driving me. And I'd like the audience to ask themselves what's driving them.
That is a perfect place to end, because it's a perfect message. So Shepherd Fairey, thank you so much. Thanks for being willing to spend the time doing this. And yeah, I know how busy you are.
And, well, it's always good
really
to talk to you, David.
Now, we've spoken in other contexts, but this has been great, great, great fun as well. And much appreciation.
Yeah, thank you, David. It was fun.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.